This is a Stimulus Network podcast.
The Cosmic Shed.
Hello and welcome to The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew and today's episode is an interview that Steve and I did with the legendary, and I don't say that lightly, the legendary science fiction author William Gibson. He is, of course, the author of the Neuromancer trilogy, who famously gave us The Matrix and coined the term cyberspace, has won multiple awards and was in Bristol doing a talk as part of the wonderful Bristol Festival of Ideas at one of our favourite places in Bristol, We the Curious, Bristol's Science Centre. He was in Bristol on his only date outside London, here in the UK, to talk about his new novel, Agency, which has ended up being, although it wasn't, as we'll discover, initially intended to be, a sequel to Peripheral, one of his previous novels, which is, of course, being turned into a big-budget Amazon series. Now, I'm a huge fan of Bristol Festival of Ideas. They have amazing speakers coming. If you are in Bristol, do look it up. And one of the things that I really like about it is that the audience are all really interested, as you might expect, in ideas. So you get some really good questions from the floor. And thanks to Bristol Festival Ideas and William Gibson himself, who have said we can use a part of that audio and bring you that now before we go to the interview. Here's one of the questions from the floor about that Peripheral series on Amazon.
I wondered, if you could tell us anything specific about the forthcoming Peripheral production, and more generally, how do you feel about letting your babies get rogered senseless by the media?
Well,
it's a stark choice, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Well, or as I prefer to think of it, allowing someone to create their own stub for Peripheral. This probably isn't the right terminology, because they seem to have reinvented all the filmmaking terminology for streaming television. But if it were a feature film, the Peripheral would be, you know, in solid pre-production. Like, it's as going to happen as anything like that is going to happen. And I've been told that it's a season order, a series order. They're gonna do a season. In the course of doing the season, I guess they decide whether they do another. It's very handsomely funded in that each of the eight episodes has a $10 million budget, the most minute percentage of which will ever reach the author of the original material. So I'm in no danger of going George Martin in my bank account anyway. But that's really almost, at this point, in part because I've been really busy with the preparation for the launch of this book for months, and that's the time in which they've been getting it together. There's a writer's room that's open and with writers working in it in New York, and there's a showrunner. Actually, there's one showrunner with two heads. There's Scott Smith, the man who's been the writer all the way through the process, and someone who's very, very experienced with the mechanics of production and with problems that arise. So they'll be running it together. The couple who brought it to Amazon, who are Jonah Nolan and Lisa Joy, who make Westworld, are not going to be running it, but I doubt that they'll be, you know, entirely hands off either. And because I have, like, pre-existing relationships with a couple of people, the director Vincenzo Natale, he'll be directing a lot of, or possibly all of the that first season. You know, I expect that, you know, my opinion will be asked at certain points. I'll be happy to give it. But that said, experience has taught me that everyone involved in something like that is desirous of maintaining as much creative control as they already have. They don't want to lose one iota of their existing control. They experience it as a loss of agency. And I think I'm well past the point of imagining that it would be worth my while to go in and fight for my sense of what it should be. I mean, for one thing, I scarcely watch television, particularly like this kind of television. It's not a media I really understand. I know more about it from reading about it on Twitter than anything else. And the other is it's not worth it for me, wouldn't be worth it to struggle with these actual professionals who are trying to make an adaptation of a book I wrote. I mean, there's a tendency in society today to somehow feel that the ultimate state of a work of prose fiction is a film or a television series. And I've never believed that, and I never will. So, I'm hoping that I will be, I'm hoping that it will, that it won't suck. I think I have good reason to hope that, considering the people who are involved in making it. And I hope that I will not succumb to being that, you know, grumpy old writer in the background who's unhappy that it's not exactly like the book, because even I don't think it should be exactly like the book. I don't even know what that would mean.
Well, I couldn't agree more with William Gibson there. It reminded me of our first episode that we did with Andy Weir. Obviously, we've spoken to Andy Weir a few times over the years, but the first one that we did before the film of The Martian was actually released, and talking to him then about the forthcoming film. If you're interested in that process at all, then I would recommend you go back and listen to our episode on The Martian, the book. I'll post a link on the website, thecosmicshed.com. And it was Steve and I's great pleasure, before he went to do the talk, to sit down with him at We the Curious and discuss his work. We began by asking him about his new book, Agency.
I had a contract for a standalone novel, which was most definitely not going to be a sequel to The Peripheral, my previous novel. I was well into it. I was sort of half of the way to having a first third of it. And when I woke up one morning, and I discovered that Donald Trump had been elected president of the United States. And I looked at the laptop containing the work in progress, and I thought, oh, this isn't good, because it's 2016 now. The story is set in 2017, and 2017 is going to be nothing like the 2017 I've been working on in this book. The zeitgeist is going to be radically different in ways that I can't predict, although I imagine they're going to be, you know, fairly unpleasant. But then I put that aside and just sort of gave myself up to my emotional reaction to Trump being elected president. It took me about 3 months to fully grieve, I think.
Right.
And but then I came back to the manuscript thinking, well, is it really over? And it suddenly occurred to me that the 2017 in the manuscript, which did not have the zeitgeist it would have had Trump been elected president, might be one of the so-called stubs from the peripheral. It might be an alternate time track triggered by essentially perverse hobbyists in 22nd century London. So I ran a couple of tests. You know, I wrote some bits, and it seemed to work. And I started working out what it could be. But it was much slower. It's proved much slower than the writing of the original manuscript, which I had been marketed to my publisher and New York basically as a lighthearted romp.
Right.
And so I knew that this wasn't going to be a lighthearted romp. But I kept going, and it proved incredibly slow going because the zeitgeist damage by the time I was actually in the real 2017 was more grotesque and severe than I could have imagined, but still there was nothing there that violated any sense the reader has in the peripheral of what that period might be like. Like, the saving grace for me was that the peripheral is full of characters who I would assume know exactly what happened and who was elected president and how that went, but they've no particular reason to think of it, so it's never been articulated. It's not out there in dialogue, and the point of view character doesn't, for that time, in the peripheral, doesn't have cause to think about it. But I kept going with it, and in the effort to keep it as uncomplex as possible, and it's still, I think, like excessively complex, just proved very time-consuming. So I think I ran through two hard deadlines before I finally got it in, and they had announced publication at least once, so that there were people who've had this thing on pre-order at Amazon for like years now. So I'm deeply grateful that they've finally gotten what they paid for. But it now looks like, given the way I work, that there's a third volume coming.
Oh.
That will be, I think, the more what happens next in the 22nd century.
Okay.
Then what happens in the stub of 2017.
So it's not going to be thrown dramatically if Trump gets impeached then?
No, that was the tricky thing. That was exactly the tricky thing, because I did a tremendous amount of work engineering the thing to prevent that. But none of that would be at all evident to a reader, because it's all in what isn't said. But I think I've got it. I mean, if there's a nuclear war, it won't be publishable anyway.
Yeah.
So we're okay. But otherwise, whether he gets impeached, or which it now looks like he won't, or that he won't be charged with anything, or whether he, you know, I hate to say it, whether he gets in again, it doesn't matter. And The other difference was that the Brexit vote went stay. And so I had mixed feelings, actually, about, I hate to admit this, but I had mixed feelings about whether I, more than, you know, I desperately wanted the UK to be able to weasel out of that and blow the whole thing off as a drunken mistake. But at the same time, I knew that it would wreck my universal joint that I was building. But as it is, here we have, you know, the perfect setup for the clip to 2023.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, you're welcome, I guess.
Yeah. If there's one benefit of it, then we get more.
Yeah. Well, that's the only benefit of it I could think of.
Yeah.
I think we can all agree we're in the weirdest, darkest timeline in reality at the moment. This sort of has echoes of what you went through in the early 2000s. You started and then restarted pattern recognition.
Yeah, pattern recognition was restarted a few weeks after 9/11.
Could you make it more difficult for yourself, do you think? I mean, you've touched a bit on the problem of sort of writing time travel, mm-hmm. and then you throw into it writing all this science and technology things. Do you not sometimes think, maybe I'll just stop? Or was that what you were trying to do with Agency?
Yeah, well, with Agency, I wanted to take a break. The Peripheral took a long time and was really a lot of work, and I'll try to, you know, pop through this one and just have fun. It was going to be a piece of contemporary science fiction and make fun of Silicon Valley billionaires and whatnot,
oh, okay.
who were, you know, an easy target.
Yeah.
But it didn't work out that way. And I'm actually pleased with how it's gone so far, because I feel like I'm holding up my end of the process.
You are quoted regularly as saying that the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed.
Yes.
Which means that the skill, therefore, is picking out which things are actually going to be the future. And I wondered if you could tell me if Donald Trump and Boris Johnson are the future.
I think they are, you know, to some degree, they're the immediate future. But beyond that, who can say? I think there's at least one British friend of mine agrees with me on this, that I think there's potential in Johnson to make a catastrophic mistake
mm-hmm.
that, you know, might bring him to grief or even shorten his term. So that's good.
Yeah.
But with Trump, the way things are going, I'm not as optimistic. Should he get in again, you know, I think the next president might be Ivanka, you
right.
know, or whatever. I mean, who knows at this point? I mean, it's one enormity after another.
Mm.
And I recently realized that quite a few people don't realize that enormity doesn't mean a great big thing. It means something unspeakably horrible.
Yeah.
You are a science fiction author. And I've read that you've wanted to write science fiction from a very young age, but you've also said that it's not the science that motivates you, and a lot of what you write is focused on the people side of things. I wanted to ask what directed you towards sci-fi with the technological focus, and how would you say your work is balanced between the two, the science and the social?
Well, when I began to try to write science fiction, I mean, when I discovered science fiction, like in that serious, hyper-nerdy way that teenage boys did in those, the mainly boys did in those days, or that was the assumption of publishers in any case, that it was a male genre. Yeah, I was into it really intensely for 3 or 4 years, really intensely. I did nothing else but read it and correspond with other fans and that sort of thing. I think I learned quite a lot about it at that time, and that was when the British New Wave movement was going full steam over here. And I discovered that, and I realized that I liked Michael Moorcock and his New World gang a lot more than I liked most of the SF that was being written and published in the United States. It was like, whoa, this is something. It was my first introduction to the idea of dissonant art. And they were like kind of openly dissonant. They, you know, they were striking dissonant poses.
Yeah.
And having a good time at it. And the American SF fans I was in touch with didn't like that at all. And they didn't get it. And something, probably puberty, distracted me from the reading of science fiction. But I left considering myself to be a British New Wave fan. So I left, you know, knowing that J.G. Ballard was always going to mean more to me than Robert Heinlein. And then a decade or so later, when I was finishing up a bachelor's degree at university in Vancouver, I started to entertain the idea of trying to write some of it myself. What determined what I wrote initially was a sort of mental wall of post-it notes of things that I thought science fiction needed at that time in order to be more like the British New Wave. And so I thought that it needed massive clinical rescue doses of naturalism, so that the characters had actual lives and had sex and did everything else. I think that says something because literary naturalism hasn't been a radical dissonant move in fiction since the early 19th century in France.
Yeah.
Everybody else takes it totally for granted. So I had that. I had the idea that the female characters needed more active and proactive roles and not to be stereotyped. I thought that I wouldn't depict, try not to depict the future as a version of America particularly. So I wanted like an international, I wanted a global milieu and characters from a lot of different cultures. And so I actually had this kind of grievance list or, you know, grudge list going in. And that wound up determining the direction my work took, and particularly by the time I found myself commissioned, amazingly, to write a first novel, which became Neuromancer. I was paying closer attention, to the list, and I think that just basic naturalism was the most radical thing for me. I mean, you know, at that time, I was years from ever having heard the term cyberpunk, or having met anyone who would have known what that meant. So I wasn't getting it from there. I was just getting it from the getting it from the post-it notes.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Because you mentioned Neuromancer. It's when you start reading it, you're immediately, in the first sentence, you're transported into the middle of the world. That immersive style of writing, can you just give me some kind of insight? What's your process that goes into that? How do you...
First, I should say that I... about that specifically, I didn't have a post-it note for that one. But as I began to try to write fiction, and I began by writing and publishing a very few short stories, I discovered that something I hadn't known about my own reading of science fiction before I tried to write it, was that my sharpest pleasure was to have the experience you just described. What I get the most kick out of in science fiction is reading the first page of a story or a novel, knowing that it makes perfect sense about something, but that I haven't a clue what that is. And then I'm into the sort of the pleasure of the chase. I keep reading for the moment when it all clicks. And in order to take a reader through that, you have to be pretty careful, because if you keep them lost too long, they'll give up. And I probably do that to some readers anyway, even now. But you'll destroy the pleasure of the chase if the clues are too obvious. So there's this very, you know, delicate game of hints and suggestions, but they don't appear that. But so there's still no sense of exposition, you know, and that's exposition in the sense of, by the way, Harold, ever since we've lived on Mars, we've eaten these ham sandwiches, and yet where do they come? You know, that sort of thing. And cause that's just a, you know, buzzkill for me in science fiction. Yeah. Too much exposition. I don't want it explained. I want the payoff when it comes. And in my books, it usually comes around the end of the first third of the length of the book. I want the payoff to be seamlessly coherent and logical, so that when you go back and read the book again, you have a completely different experience, because you know exactly what's going on. And so I've always given myself over to that, even though I've often suspected that I'm losing some part of the audience. A few times, I think I've even been guilty of deliberately trying to lose part of the audience on the first page or so, just so that I won't have to worry about them anymore.
Right. I confess that the first time I read Neuromancer, I found the first few chapters tough going, but I think that was because I was a more immature reader at the time, and when I came back to it, I did get a lot of pleasure of that immersive, not really knowing where things are going. I can definitely feel that in your writing. It's nice to hear that it's at least in some part intended.
I think that's fascinating. You want to get rid of some of the readers. That's...
Well, the people who... It isn't that I resent them for not getting me, but they tend to be the readers who don't get writers terrifically fond of reading. They just don't get it, and they want, generally because they want certain rewards which genre structures provide, which I'm not very interested in giving the reader. I mean, I'll do it sometimes if I find it interesting or agreeable. But, I mean, it was really a strange and suicidal mission that I was on at the beginning, it seemed to me, because I wanted to be published and read, and I wanted to write
this science fiction that I sensed I had there to write, if I had an opportunity, I didn't want to have to actually meet what I thought of as the standards of genre readers. I was imagining that somewhere there's a different audience. There's a genre literate audience that also reads, say, Thomas Pynchon or Kurt Vonnegut. And I thought, you know, if enough of those guys can find me, I might be okay.
I do. You know, when you were saying about, well, you've, agency and the peripheral, you had to sort of restart or at least move what you were doing. When you write, like specifically this one, Neuromancer, when you write that first sentence, do you know the whole rest of the story?
Goodness me, no. And in fact, that first paragraph or so, that was probably rewritten 2,000 times. And this version of it would have been the last rewrite. But I'm structurally incapable, as far as I know, of producing a story outline that would be of any interest to me to then execute, and indeed, or would be of really much interest to anyone else to read, because that's the part of my mind that's having this conversation with you guys.
Yeah.
It's not the part of my mind that actually writes the books, which I don't have ready access to, and largely don't even have conscious access to. I just have to get myself into a state, non-chemical, but, in which give that part a framework within which to manifest things, and it will surprise me. It feels like it's not even mine. It is, of course, but it's some unconscious part of me. And nothing gives me more pleasure in writing than when that unconscious part produces something that I could never in a million years have dreamed up. So in a way, my whole technique is about leaving it open. There's something else that's much more mysterious and I don't really understand it. It starts happening in what will become the final third of the book, where it moving toward finding some sort of closure that will allow me to, as a friend of mine used to say, finally hear the click.
Okay.
And it's like a distinct click when you've gotten to the end of the thing. But it's a terribly inefficient way of writing. And one thing it means that I start in the morning, I read through virtually the entire existent manuscripts, making like micro changes all the way through. And then I get to what Bruce Sterling used to call the working face, and or new, you know, new granite to carve, and go on from there. It's the only way I've ever been able to do it. And the idea of not being in control of it, I probably owe to, of all people, E.M. Forster, who in his Aspects of the Novel said that, it's not a quote, but he said in effect that if a novelist is in control of the direction of the narrative, that they're not doing the work.
Yeah.
They're not really there. Like he wanted to, I think, get to where I eventually able to get to. And so I read that a couple of years before I started trying to write and sort of folded that in with the post-it notes as well.
Do you feel that when you're at that working face that things flow, or is it constant effort to produce?
Well, it flows, you know, it flows until it doesn't, and then things stop and other things have to be done, and then it gets going again, and it flows again. It sort of needs to toward the end, it needs to maintain a fairly constant momentum of composition. Start with, you know, pettishly pecking at the keyboard in the beginning, looking at the blank screen, and progress to the middle where it's sort of discovered, seems to have discovered what it is, although it won't tell me, but it's moving quite along. And that's when it'll flow, stop, flow, stop, flow, stop. But if I'm fortunate, and it varies, you know, from book to book, if I'm fortunate, the final third is the result of, I don't know, writing too much, like, you know, not getting enough sleep, like that sort of thing. Because if I put it down, it's going to be too much work to spin all the plates up again and get it wobbling across the table toward whatever its peculiar destiny is.
I may have, in my youth, been one of those people that you didn't care about continuing with your books, and I was attracted initially to your work partly because of the aesthetic of it, and you've created worlds and influenced or even played a part in creating lots of real-world subcultures. But thank you for not putting me off too much, because I have had my eyes open to a whole lot of new literature, including Pynchon and others that you mentioned, through your work.
Thank you very much. I'm glad I didn't succeed in blowing you off. I think what I was really... I haven't had that sense of doing that for a long time now, but I think that perhaps what I was doing was, by doing that, I freed myself from having to return to whatever anxieties I had about accessibility.
I really would like to talk to you all night, but I'm aware you've got to do a talk soon, so we should probably let you go.
That was very enjoyable.
I'm going to put that on my CV.
it was extremely enjoyable.
Thank you so much to Bristol Festival of Ideas. Do look them up, and We the Curious, and of course William Gibson, for talking to us. And obviously we'll post links to where you can buy his books, but I'm sure you already know, on the Cosmic Shed website, thecosmicshed.com. We'll be back soon with another episode. I'm not sure what yet, but I hope you're all enjoying Picard on Amazon Prime. And thank you very much for listening. The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between.
This podcast is brought to you by the Stimulus Network.